Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Jim Macklin. I am sitting in for Neil
Welcome
Garfield.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show.
This is Thursday, April 10th, 2014, and I am broadcasting from Lake Tahoe, Nevada. Today's show is brought to you by the Living Lies web blog, GTC Honors, the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, LLC, with offices in Tallahassee, Fort Lauderdale, and also brought to you from donations to the Living Lies web blog from listeners like you. If you are at your computer listening in, either through your computer or by phone, you can ask a question or join our chat room by clicking on the link to the Neil Garfield Show. You'll find that link on the front page of the Living Lies web blog. Thanks for joining us on the show today, and thank you not only for your donations of money, but for contributions to the facts and analysis being presented on the blog at www.wordpress.livinglies.com. And remember, if you miss any of the shows, you can always come to this site and download past shows. If you would like a transcript, something can be worked out with regard to that as well. If you would like to schedule an event with Neil or a conversation, please call 520-405-1688 or 954-495-9867. If you have any interest in scheduling something with myself or my guest, you can contact my offices of Secure Document Research at 530-888-9600. That's 530-888-9600. Folks, I would first like to thank Neil for having me host today's show. He will be back in a few weeks, and I would like to also thank Dan Edstrom for being my guest today. A quick note for disclosure and disclaimer, neither Dan or myself are attorneys. The purpose of this show is not for purporting or giving legal advice. The show is for entertainment purposes only and may not be used as a legal opinion. A little background about Dan Edstrom before I bring him on. Dan is the senior analyst at Living Lies and also is the managing director of his company, DTC Systems, out here in California. Dan and I have worked very closely together for the last 5 years or so. Through our combined efforts and work, we have produced some very beneficial settlement results, both in the litigation venue as well as in bankruptcy courts, really all over the United States. Dan's background is in the IT field with a very focus on complex transactions. Dan has been featured on MSNBC, CNN, The Huffington Post, and had research entered and permanently recorded in the congressional record for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee hearings on mortgage foreclosure fraud. The members of that committee deemed the research as, quote, absurd but accurate, end of quote, meaning that the absurdity of the design and the overall schematic of what Dan presented at first sight seems absurd, but when thoroughly investigated ends up being absurdly accurate. Before I do get to Dan, I want to preface a few items from our show subject matter today. And the matter at hand today is how tax law determines ownership interests in REMIC trusts. For those of you who do not know what a REMIC trust is, it is a pass-through vehicle that's used for a specific tax treatment of cash flows that are generated by mortgage payments. When the REMIC is properly funded and assets are timely and lawfully conveyed into such a trust, the income that's derived from the vehicle is treated as 100% tax exempt. Because the participants in the revenue from this REMIC elected to use this form of tax treatments, then obviously the laws of the Internal Revenue Code will govern the assets and also determine if the assets were conveyed into the trust timely and under the strict provisions of the code and under other provisions of the pooling and servicing agreements. We can think of the REMIC as a big funnel for income to the parties that purchased AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities. However, the funnel had to be full at the closing date of the REMIC trust. The income coming out of the other end of the funnel is no longer tax-free. It would rather be taxed at 100% tax rate. So the requirements for timely transfer of assets into these REMIC vehicles were and remain critical to the trust's claims of ownership. So let's establish some authorities for the trust's claim of ownership of the asset. First, federal tax law does not rely upon the state law definition of ownership. It rather looks to state law to determine parties' rights, obligations, and interests in the property. And there are several U.S. cases that support this contention. A U.S. case would act as a primary mandatory authority for a state or a federal court. In other words, walking into a courtroom, if you're starting to define the ownership characteristics of the asset loan, then federal tax law is going to be the determinative law that you would like to talk about. The tax definition of ownership, and with ownership naturally comes standing, in other words, the standing to be in front of a court, the ownership and standing applies to mortgage notes claimed as assets of a subject REMIC trust. And there are several authorities, including Bradley Borden and David Reese Beneficial Ownership and REMIC Classification and Tax Management Real Estate Rules. These authorities are very important in pleading practice because standing is a threshold issue and may be brought up at any time. Unfortunately, we see attorneys that don't address this when they should be addressing this really most foundational matter up at the beginning of a case and in pleading, and then demanding an answer as to the standing of the parties. This can result in a substantial blow to the opposition if it's brought properly, and especially when it's hammered home by the lawyer. Courts are going to focus on whether the benefits and burdens of ownership pass from one party to another when considering who is the owner of property for tax purposes. And this, again, is a well-settled premise in the U.S. tax courts, and there are many authorities that support this premise. Because this is a U.S. tax court decision and many decisions that support this, this would also be something that an attorney would want to bring in up front as a binding authority to bring the court's attention to how we want to establish who owns the debt. And if tax law determines that ownership interest, then the analysis of ownership doesn't merely look to the agreements that the party had entered into, because the label that parties give to a transaction does not determine that transaction's character. And again, very large and well-settled U.S. case law that supports that last contention. So to put all those four pieces together, we have to bring to the court's attention that any of the documents that are being waltzed into courtrooms by the other side that were either filed at the county level or in some instances at a different level, that those documents are incident to the question of who owns the debt. The bottom line is the analysis has to examine the underlying economics and the attendant facts and circumstances to determine who owns the mortgage notes for tax purposes. This very issue was painfully analyzed in several major appellate court decisions and has been found to be controlling. One of the biggest burdens that have plagued borrowers here in California, and I think throughout the U.S., is the court's unwillingness to accept the borrower as a party to the pooling and servicing agreements. However, under the argument that I just put forth, it's our contention that the borrower is definitely a party and a third-party intended beneficiary to the tax laws of the United States. Although there have been several cases that suggest otherwise with respect to borrowers being part of the PSA, the majority opinion is that the borrower has not established themselves as a party to these REMIC trust agreements. So we're going to look today at how an attorney should approach this really a difficult area. I'm going to bring in our guest, Dan Edstrom, right now. Dan, I'll ask you to unmute and jump online. I want to welcome Dan and ask you, Dan, can you hear everything okay? As I mentioned, Dan has been an integral part of Living Lies as a senior analyst, and he and I have together been digging very deeply into the patterns and practices of the mortgage servicing industry to determine what it is that they rely on for their never-ending march toward owning these foreclosure properties. Dan, thanks for coming on board. Thanks for listening. And I just wanted to ask you if you can expand on what I just covered from the perspective of tax law governing the ownership interests and how the lawyer can use this as a strategy to force early decisions by the courts as to standing.
Well, there's a presumption, first of all, that the documents presented by the bank are valid, and that would be, you know, the note and the security instrument. And in the case of a REMIC, you have the pooling and servicing agreement and the other governing documents, and typically those documents aren't brought forward. In fact, they don't even typically establish that the REMIC itself was ever created and it actually exists. In the case of standing, coming into court and claiming standing, if you can push the burden onto the other side, to prove it, you'd need to bring the evidence that the REMIC itself was supposed to be established at a certain time, and then show that the loan itself didn't get transferred into it until a later date, which is usually done through an assignment that either was recorded or not recorded in most cases.
So let's talk about that. And you and I have gone back and forth on this. There's a number of controlling issues that talk about how this was allegedly conveyed. Of course, in the record, in most records, they will make a purported assignment by either MERS or some substituted trustee or an agent where they will execute an instrument that purports to assign the deed of trust together with the note into this REMIC classified tax entity. And let's talk about the closing date REMIC before we talk about these assignments. In these REMIC trusts, there's a closing date that's established within the confines of the instrument and also that's established by tax law under Internal Revenue Code at Section 860. So, Dan, talk about the relevance of the closing date.
The closing date is the time at which the assets are to be conveyed into the REMIC. So at that point, or possibly within 90 days of that date, is the end time for which you can transfer or contribute into the trust.
Right. So now following that up, within the construct of the pooling and servicing agreement, usually at Section 2.01, there's a provision for conveyances of the mortgage loans. And under that section of the pooling and servicing agreement, there are typically a minimum of two parties that must take possession of the loan. They must purchase it for good and valuable consideration, accept it, physical transfer of the note and the deed, and actually pay for a valuable consideration. And these two parties are typically who?
Typically the sponsor and the depositor.
Right. And now we look to the structure of the transaction. And this is where we talked about this on Neil's show about 3 weeks ago, how this relates to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, which has been adopted by every state in the country, I believe, except Louisiana, as a commercial code. And under Article 9, these transactions are very specifically controlled. And so under Article 9, you are required under what they call the law of assignments to show these intermediary transactions as they are set forth in the pooling and servicing agreement. And there's a couple of very unique things about the depositor in these REMIC trusts that we know typically hold to be true, the first of which is most of these depositors never had a bank account, nor does the trust. But we now relate this back directly to the assignment where the party, let's call it a MERS, a typical MERS loan, has purported to assign this loan from MERS as nominee for usually the named lender into this trust directly. And what's the problem with that under Article 9 Law of Assignments?
I'm sorry, I meant you broke up on the last one. MERS transferring into the trust?
If MERS executes an assignment of the deed of trust or an assignment of mortgage into the REMIC trust in 2010 and they have not included any of the intermediary parties in the pooling and servicing agreement and the trust closed in 2005, tell me some of the problems that you see with that type of an assignment, and let's talk about the statute of frauds when you answer that question.
Sure. One of the problems is that in virtually every transaction that I've seen, the depositor is not a MERS member. Secondly, of course, we have the time is after the REMIC itself closed by years in which you're not allowed to add any more contributions into the trust. And let's see. One of the other issues you have is that usually the note has already been endorsed from the originator to another party, and in most of these cases with the MERS assignment, you've got MERS transferring the loan from the originator as nominee for the originator, which means the note was sold to one party and the security instrument was sold to another party.
So a couple of key things there. Under the statute of frauds, in California at least, and this is probably relevant throughout different jurisdictions, but under the statute of fraud, a conveyance of an interest in real property is only conveyed by a writing or by an instrument. No other interest is conveyed prior to that writing. Would you agree with that surmise of the statute?
Correct. A transfer of an interest in real property is done at a specific time by a specific entity, and the information surrounding that has to be certain. The requirements around it have to be certain. So, for instance, you couldn't transfer an interest in real property to an attorney in fact, and you couldn't transfer an interest in real property to a nominee without naming the principal, just as you couldn't transfer an interest to a trustee without naming a specific trust.
That's right.
So the issue with that, from the perspective of the governing documents for the REMIC, is that the REMIC alleges that the transfer of the note and the security instrument were at the closing date, which is years before, but no interest in real property is transferred because there's no assignment.
That's right. So now, let's equate that to the typical scenario that we have in a courtroom where a homeowner is trying to establish before the court that they have any business poking their nose into the interests of this pooling and servicing agreement. So we know that state law always includes federal law, because federal law is considered the supreme law of the land. That's under the United States Constitution in Article 6, Section 2. We end up with a simple premise that any violation of federal law is a violation of all law for the purposes of determining whether or not a contract is unenforceable, as it would be contrary to public policy, right? We want to talk about something that adds to this, and we've got to get this in because we're down to only about 8 or 9 minutes. And we want to talk about the single or step transaction doctrine, which Neil has been touting as a valid claim since as early as 2007, 2008, probably before that. I've gone back and checked some of our notes with Neil from 5, 6 years ago. And Neil was always fixed on this doctrine, which the step transaction or single step transaction doctrine is a doctrine of law that says that when a party elects to create a transaction for the purposes of obtaining a particular tax treatment of that transaction, then all parts of the transaction may be treated as a single transaction and the intermediary step may be disregarded. So as we apply this to our typical homeowner, first I'm going to ask you, Dan, and I know that you and I have looked at thousands of cases in California together. How many cases have you seen where any lawyer or borrower in pro per actually has pled this as a predicate fact in any courtroom in these types of cases?
Very, very few, if any.
I only know of two, and that would be mine and another party. And so where this particular set of predicate facts is pled, what you are telling the court is, A, here are some mandatory authorities that the other party in this case is bound under federal tax law, and we're going to determine the enforceability of a contract under that tax law. And under the single or step transaction doctrine, why don't you talk a little bit about that, about the requirements and about what this doctrine means?
Sure. The step transaction doctrine has three tests to determine whether or not a series of transactions are a single transaction. And one of them that I focus on primarily is the binding commitment test. And this test just asks that prior to the original transaction, were there binding commitments, for instance, that said that the parties that are entering this transaction, that another transaction needs to take place. And when reviewing the governing documents for the trust, virtually every single one has an assignment assumption agreement or a mortgage loan purchase agreement that talks about the fact that they're getting these loans from the originator, and it references contracts that exist between the originator and the sponsor to buy the loans. And when you track back the dates of these agreements predated the loan closing from the homeowner when they went in and allegedly got their original loan.
Right. And so let's talk, and that's exactly the point that I was looking at, but let's also talk about the intent and purpose of the REMIC Trust. In all of these pooling and servicing agreements, they all refer to the intent of the trust. And Dan, share with everybody what the intent and purpose of the trust is.
The intent and purpose of the trust is basically to take borrower payments on the underlying mortgage loans and pass them through to the investors. And I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about.
Right. Was the intent and purpose of the trust to use the proceeds from the sales of those securities to fund mortgage loans?
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. As Neil stated, in virtually all cases, the securities were sold before the home loans were entered into at closing.
And because the intent and purpose of the tax treatment of the REMIC was to be used to fund these mortgage loans, what you now have is a nexus. You have a straight line from the parties that purchased mortgage securities to the direct funding of mortgage loans in the general marketplace. And so now we look at the let's use the end results test in the step transaction doctrine. Under the
let me speak to what you just said first, and that is the fact that what's missing is for the endorsements and assignments that either do or don't exist for all the intermediaries. What's missing is actual consideration that transferred from each of those entities. So even if you have an endorsement or an assignment, they're without consideration.
And without consideration, you just usurped the intent of Article 9. The transaction or the conveyance cannot occur without the good and valuable consideration from the specific party in each of these intermediary transactions. And this is where you had some landmark cases in Massachusetts, one recently in California, that pointed out that the borrower actually has a duty. And most people are unaware of this fact, but under the deeds of trust in most mortgages, the borrower warrants and covenants that they will defend title against all others. This is a contractual provision, and I believe that necessitates the challenge to the tax ownership definition of who owns this loan. Dan?
Right. And, when you look at the off-record transactions, look at who's buying foreclosures today and the risk that they're taking on because of the off-record transactions and a previous owner of the property coming after them in a lawsuit. You've got title companies who don't cover off-record transactions, so the title company is basically not going to stand up and defend them.
Well, and I agree with that. And so let me ask you, why do you think it is that the typical attorney's office are not using these well-settled, well-founded premises as a means of connecting in a straight line and creating that nexus of the multiple transactions where the certificate holders who funded the loans, the borrowers who accepted the money at closing, that these steps that are obviously all part of the same transaction, why do you think that law firms either shy away from this fail to see it? We've only got about 30 seconds left, Dan, so answer that quickly.
Okay, I would say complexity and knowledge. I don't have much time, so I won't agree with that now.
Right. So overall, if you look at the recent arguments that are now being raised suggesting that Article 9 governs these transactions from the beginning and some of the article or the items that we've raised today, look forward and think about that. And we just want to say thank you to everybody.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to The Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lines Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglies.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.